Before I came to law school, I was a sixth grade math teacher in a school in that was in a low-income community in Baltimore, Maryland.
First-year law student Nathan Abelman.
Every year, students with disabilities are required to have an IEP meeting, an individualized education plan. And so the meeting is to determine if the accommodations that have been used in the past are still helpful for them or if the IEP needs to be updated. These IEP meetings were held in a pseudo conference room that the school had. Usually, the way it would work was the general education teacher would share their concerns. The special education teacher would share their concerns. The parent would share any concerns that they had. And then we would try to reach some consensus on which accommodations had to stay, which had to be added, and which were no longer necessary.
A lot of dispute resolution and conflict management theory is centered around conducting successful conversations. But before we can get there, we have to get people to sit down and talk to each other in the first place. Nathan's school had to convene a group that included the special education teachers, general education teachers, and parents in order to feel like the decision process would mean something. And sometimes it was a struggle.
I felt as a math teacher that some of the accommodations that were in these kids' IEPs were actually counterproductive to their education. So, although I was required by law to be at the meeting, I didn't necessarily feel a sense of buy-in, at least in some cases. So, for example, one accommodation that a lot of kids who had disabilities received for math class was a calculator. I felt like that prevented kids from learning math that they otherwise may have been able to learn. My main thought during these meetings was just a sense of frustration that no matter what accommodations we gave kids, it wouldn't usually be enough to help them reach the level of their peers who lacked a disability.
Nathan was able to come to the table despite his reservations.
Because the meetings weren't about how I, as a teacher, was feeling, the meetings were about trying to make sure that a kid who had really serious barriers would be given some sorts of tools to overcome those barriers. My feeling that the meeting wasn't enough really isn't relevant to at least trying to help the kid.
So teachers like Nathan were often there, but
Parents usually were not there. Sometimes the parents would phone in, but other times the parents did not participate in the meeting at all.
Nathan's school always wanted parents' participation and valued their input. But for some parents, it was difficult to come to school for a one-hour meeting when many of them worked, sometimes far away from school, didn't have access to a car, or couldn't take time off. Other parents had different reasons for not coming.
Nathan describes one particular meeting where the parent did come, and her experience with the school system helps us understand why it was sometimes difficult to get other parents involved.
This was a meeting that involved myself and the sixth grade social studies teacher and the special education teacher. The student's mother was present. The school psychologist was present. This was not an official IEP meeting. This was kind of a meeting before we got to that step. The student was still being tested to see if he had a disability, although we were pretty confident that he did. So the student did not have an IEP yet. But this kid had fallen through the cracks for years, I think because he was a really good kid who always behaved and did not demand a lot of attention from teachers. So although his academic performance was low, he just wasn't a kid that teachers were concerned about. And I think that's why it took us a long time to realize that there was a problem. During this meeting, a lot of those frustrations that the mother had with the school system really came through. She had moved him to three different schools since kindergarten, and we were the fourth. And in all of those schools, he had just been pushed to the next grade without really having learned what he needed to learn. So this mother was extremely frustrated, as was I as his teacher. This kid was clearly very far behind. So although that's a case where everyone did come to the table, I think those frustrations were pretty typical and show why other parents did not necessarily come to the table in other IEP meetings.
Negotiations happen at a metaphorical and sometimes literal table. So today, we explore who's at the table, who isn't, and the impact that has on the decisions we make together. Welcome. You're in the listening room.
From the Harvard Negotiation and Mediation Clinical Program at Harvard Law School, this is a podcast dedicated to better understanding negotiation skills,
how they're being used in practice,
where they're succeeding,
and where they might be falling short.
I'm Sarah Del Nido Butish, a clinical fellow at the Harvard Negotiation and Mediation Clinical Program.
And I'm Deanna Parrish, a third-year alumna of the program. We're both great fans of audio as a medium for sharing and learning, and even greater fans of good stories.
The stories you'll hear will help you look at negotiations in your own life and might even help you deal with some of the challenges you face.
Let's imagine a negotiation table where the people who have a stake are clamoring for a seat, where you couldn't possibly seat everyone who could contribute to the conversation. And even if you could, it would be hard to give everyone an equal voice in the outcome.
How do you pick and choose between everyone who wants a seat? And once you do they represent themselves or others?
There was no idea classified as stupid, in advance of it being put on the table. People would say this idea might be completely nuts, but let me tell you about it.
Richard Nephew worked for 12 years in the U.S. government and most recently served for about 2 years as a sanctions expert on the U.S. team negotiating the Iran nuclear program.
This was really a series of negotiations.
Between countries, between levels of government.
Involving hundreds of people. And not all of them could be at the table at once. It's not President Obama's job or Secretary Kerry's job to think about this one issue all day, every day. It just can't be.
So how do you manage that? Too many stakeholders and too few seats at the table, especially when everyone seemed to have a different idea about how to negotiate this problem.
Part of the issue is, too, that, some of these ideas are pretty good. I mean, there were things that we hadn't thought of, or there were solutions that we hadn't really considered. And this is where you're not going to get it in every negotiation, but, there was a peculiarly large number of people interested in this outcome. Right, there were Middle East experts who were interested in the outcome. There were non-proliferation experts interested in the outcome. There were sanctions experts interested in the outcome, and everybody in between, beyond the actual other country audiences. And so there were a lot of people who had a stake, and there were a lot of people who had an interest, and there were a lot of ideas thrown out there over a negotiation that also took 18 months.
In such a large group, where the task wasn't even fully defined yet, how did the team even start?
Well, the vision came from the very top.
There is no grand bargain being discussed here in the context of this negotiation. This is about a nuclear weapon potential. That's it.
That's Secretary Kerry. He's responding to Congress's doubts about his team's efforts.
And the president has made it absolutely clear they will not get a nuclear weapon. Now, the presumption by a lot of people up on the Hill here has been that we somehow aren't aware of that goal, even as we negotiate that goal. Our negotiation is calculated to make sure they can't get a nuclear weapon. And it's really almost insulting that the presumption...
The president gave us strategic guidance. And the president's strategic guidance was that he wants Iran not to be able to acquire a nuclear weapon, and that, we have lots of time to detect any kind of move in that direction. I mean, that's good strategic level guidance.
So the president sets a vision that helps the negotiators evaluate their task. But it wasn't that simple.
It wasn't a vision that was just uttered by one group. It was a vision that was assembled, from a number of constituent parts, starting off with presidential leadership and going back to the staff level expert guys to figure out how to do it, and then kind of culminating in a recommendation back to the president, and saying to him, boss, you asked us to tell you how we would solve this problem for you. This is what our proposal would be on solving the problem in gross terms.
The president has signed off on the plan. Now what?
Then we went about the very nitty-gritty work of figuring out the constituent parts. Can you do it with 3,000 centrifuges or 5,000 centrifuges or 50,000 centrifuges? Mm-hmm. But at no point did we get told, as experts, we must have 2,000 centrifuges or bust. Instead, it was a very objective, focused set of criteria. Solve the problem, which is nuclear weapons in Iran, and make sure that it's a solved problem for a good long period of time.
The president had to set a vision that was both flexible enough to allow the negotiating team to learn on its feet and specific enough to provide a practical roadmap to the negotiators on the ground.
So, what does that nitty-gritty work look like? Because everyone couldn't be at the table, there's a lot of talking that happens within the team, and every team has its own tone.
Richard's team benefited from all the time together, and things remain friendly. Mostly.
To some extent, you couldn't help but interact with the rest of the team because we spent 18 to 20 hours a day with one another for 18 months.
Oh, wow.
And so it actually would have been better at some points if we had not been as close as we ended up being. Because at some point, that kind of close quarters does breed something in addition to collegiality.
Okay. So there's something in addition to collegiality. But for the most part, it sounds like the team was well-functioning. And most importantly, there was an ethic of inclusiveness when it came to ideas.
There was a spirited discussion about whether or not the idea itself was meritorious, but there was no criticism of putting the ideas on the table, because we all recognized that, you know, something had to give, and we had to come up with some kind of solution, and who knows, the crazy idea from one guy might end up, you know, being the one. And I think, you know, there's an example of that, which is the idea that one of Iran's facilities become an advanced but fundamental physics facility. In the end, in the negotiations, that idea, which came up at dinner one of the nights of the negotiation, actually made it to the final document and is going to be the future of that facility. That idea was talked out in between tacos, but it was something that you know, we all thought about, we all worked on, we all talked through, and then we made it to the final product.
This spirit of brainstorming didn't come out of nowhere. In fact, there was direction from the top to conduct the team this way.
Part of John's job and part of the Iranian negotiator's job and part of the P5 plus one's job is to sometimes find formulas that get to our main concerns while allowing the other side to make a presentation to their body politic that is more acceptable.
So President Obama rejects that there's one single solution to this issue.
And I think that goal of having in reserve the possibility of putting back and applying forceful sanctions in the event of a violation, that goal can be met. And it'll require some creative negotiations by John Kerry and others.
A creative process requires brainstorming. And successful brainstorming is inclusive. Once you forego a one-size-fits-all model of negotiation, you have no reason not to consider as many ideas as possible.
Consensus building is appealing as an alternative to traditional ways of doing things, because in the end, it saves time, it saves money, it leaves people in a better position to work together, and it produces the most creative agreements rather than what are called lowest common denominator, barely acceptable agreements.
That's Lauren Susskind, professor and head of the Environmental Policy and Planning Group at MIT's Urban Planning School and founder of the Consensus Building Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
He writes about how consensus-based processes for group decision-making can lead to creative solutions for challenging policy issues. The Iran negotiations in particular lent themselves to inclusivity. With a subject matter so technical, it took a lot of people to work through the details. Here's Richard Nephew again.
There's no right or wrong answer on how to solve a centrifuge problem, right? There may be 8 different right answers, and it's just a question of finding which is the one that'll actually work. And I think this lends itself to having more ideas on the table that we're thinking about than you might have in other talks.
You have to wonder, though, with so many people on the team
and so many experts going up to bat for their special interest area,
and even a countless number of external actors putting pressure on the negotiation, it might get to be just a little too much. Here's where we should think back to the clip we played earlier of John Kerry getting annoyed at Congress.
In this negotiation, there was a lot of external application of pressure. Everything from the terms of the negotiation, what should be in bounds and what should be out of bounds, the timing of the negotiation, what our deadlines ought to be. I mean, there was really no part of the negotiation that wasn't to some extent subject to external, not just advice, but you could even in some instances call it micromanagement, you know, because it is so sensitive. You know, it's a subject that's near and dear to a lot of people's hearts. It's near and dear to a lot of security interests of both, you know, Americans, but also our international partners. And so there were a lot of external actors that were putting in their voice.
But even with some micromanagement, Richard and his team kept their focus on the goal, which was to arrive at the best agreement possible based on the guidance they were given.
I mean, there are probably 50 different solutions to the whole problem that at one point or another were put on the table. And I think, you know, at one point we had documents that had 5 or 6 different scenarios that random experts on the team came up with. You know, I came up with about 3 different solutions that I, you know, proudly announced were the solution. You know, this will solve the problem. And, you know, there may be 2% of those ideas that are actually in the final document. but that was part of the process, actually, was everybody coming up with their own vision of how this thing could be solved and then borrowing from one another. And I don't think that, again, at the end, there were any ideas that weren't thought of, even if they couldn't be accommodated based on either the conflict that they would have with some other idea or the conflict they would have with some other negotiating partner.
So we're starting to understand why this negotiation took 18 months, if not longer. A huge number of stakeholders whose opinions were being processed, examined, analyzed, and maybe incorporated by the smaller team.
But even so, inevitably, not everyone will feel represented.
The best way that I can describe it is we took them all in. You know, we took the reactions and views and comments that we heard. And I think a lot of people would suggest we didn't, and that we were ignoring this group or the other. We were ignoring the Israelis. We were ignoring Congress. We were ignoring, you know, Gulf Arab states. That's simply not true. You know, we took on board all the ideas that were put in front of us. And some of the ideas, including from some of our worst critics, are in the final text because we wanted to make it as palatable as we could to the people who were interested in it. And it's not because we were trying to sell it. It's because we actually took on board some of the concerns that were raised, some of the issues that were raised. But, you know, in the end, those kind of external voices at some point need to be put in context of what's achievable. And they also need to be put in context of higher priorities. In the end, the final agreement, the final product, is the child of many, many different parents, including some of the parents who'd rather wish that we hadn't had the child in the first place.
Richard Nephew is the director for Economic Statecraft, Sanctions, and Energy Markets at Columbia University's Center for Global Energy Policy.
And so what happens when a similarly inclusive process is used in a totally different environment? What about a table that's really hard to fill, but once you're there, your voice is guaranteed to be heard?
To explore that, we're going to totally shift gears and contexts.
We're going to go from the global to the local.
From macro to micro.
From Tehran to Baltimore.
Everybody who was being affected by that had a voice in that meeting, and that's very powerful. We all want to make decisions for ourselves. If two people came up with that great solution, that we were going to have a football league, but the people needing to be involved in it weren't there, so they're going to be like, screw you.
That's Lauren Abramson, the executive director of the Community Conferencing Center. You'll hear more about that football league later.
Basically, what we do is provide a safe space in a circle for people to collectively do a very radical thing, which is to talk to each other in the wake of crime and conflict and give them a chance to see if they can resolve it themselves.
It's a deceptively simple structure.
Everybody knows coming into that circle, into that meeting, that the group is going to talk about three things in that order. That first, they're going to hear what's been happening that's causing the issues. And second, everybody in the circle is going to get a chance to say how they are being affected by what's been happening. And after everybody's had a chance to speak, the group's going to see if they can come up with a way to make this better and prevent it from happening again.
Lauren actually has a doctorate in neuroscience and animal behavior and was studying how emotions affect health and illness when she came across the concept of community conferencing from her colleagues in Australia.
She adapted it from the Maori people of New Zealand, where everyone connected to a conflict comes together to collectively decide how to handle the situation. When she learned more about this process, she thought, why not bring this to the American criminal justice system?
A big part of it is that the inclusive piece, which we don't do in this country very often. You know, we usually separate people or we limit these conversations to just a few key people.
Yeah.
And that's entirely appropriate in some situations. I'm not saying that this is the only way to do it, but when a lot of people are affected, if you include everybody who's affected by it in the conversation and in deciding how to fix it, then they're going to be invested in the outcomes. Mm-hmm. But if a couple people... it's only their voice and they decide what needs to happen, then the rest of the people who aren't included are less likely to abide by it.
So Lauren's work is led by inclusivity. The people involved in these conferences have a stake in what happened and also what will happen moving forward. And what's amazing is that this inclusivity seems to work.
It equalizes the talkers with the non-talkers.
This is Howard Zare, a professor at Eastern Mennonite University and a scholar on restorative justice.
That's one of the, in the restorative justice field, circle processes have been so powerful because they kind of equalize that since everybody gets an equal chance to speak.
According to Zare, who has deep experience in a wide range of restorative and circle practices, giving everyone a chance to talk helps to even the playing field amongst the parties. This is what Lauren aims for in her work. The Community Conferencing Center's website reports that 98% of conferences result in written agreements, and among those, there's a 95% compliance rate.
One case in particular is really amazing. It was a neighborhood conflict that had been going on for 2 years, where neighbors had been calling the police about teenagers playing ball in the street. People's cars had been damaged and there was a lot of noise.
And the Community Conferencing Center stepped in and said, what if instead of calling the police, we all came together and talked about what's going on? What if we brainstormed some solutions? The facilitators worked hard to identify the stakeholders and bring them to the table. On the day of the conference, 44 people connected to the conflict showed up.
For the first time, the neighbors actually spoke to the teenagers and asked them why they were playing in the street when there was a park nearby. And the teenagers had the opportunity to respond. Not to a police officer, but to their neighbor. The park wasn't clean, they said, and they were worried about getting beat up there. During this meeting, every person had a chance to vocalize to the group how they'd been affected by the situation. The whole thing lasted about 2 hours.
One of the people at this conference was a guy named Don Fergus. Don knew this conflict well. He was a neighbor whose car had been keyed and dented by the kids. And he was really angry when he first got there.
But at some point during the conversation, something shifted. Don offered a solution. He said, tomorrow, I'll go with my friends and chaperone you guys at the park while you're playing football.
The next day, 21 kids showed up, and they kept showing up and bringing their friends. 3 weeks later, Don and his friends were coaching 64 kids 4 days a week.
And that football league grew into 100 players, a cheerleading squad, and 40 adult chaperones, and the league still exists.
Now it's a kickball league.
It's just a powerful story of how they, you know, took all the conflict and issues of kids not having anything positive to do, of racial tensions, of, you know, cross-cultural communication, cross-generational communication. There were some adults there that just never spoke to young people who after this, like, it was just amazing how the relationships were transformed after this. And so, you know, it's kind of this stark story of how 2 years of calling the police didn't result in the conflict being addressed, whereas this one meeting that lasted less than 2 hours transformed the whole situation.
For Lauren, community conferencing is not just a means to an end, but an end in of itself.
Many participants seem to agree.
It was excellent in terms of diffusing the problem that I saw.
There was accountability, and people had assignments that became incumbent upon them to resolve.
We spoke to one another, and we listened to one another, and that was the biggest thing.
It's allowed a lot of people to hear each other, and that's something that hasn't happened before.
What's clear when you talk to Lauren is that she really believes in her work, especially when it comes to tackling deep-seated and systemic issues.
I think what's been amazing for me about doing this work is that, you know, since the late 90s when we started providing this in Baltimore, the conferences became these spaces where racial tensions and racial conflicts would arise.
Lauren has led over 3,000 community conferences in Baltimore since the center's opening in 1998.
I've been doing this for 25 years, and you know, we've been using this as an alternative to court for misdemeanor and felony offenses. I think there's really no limit to how this can be used. And when I started doing it, you know, I'd make a presentation to the police and they're like, gosh, this makes a lot of sense.
In order to make conferencing work as a model, Laura needs stakeholder buy-in. One set of stakeholders are the people at the conferences, and we've heard about getting them there. Another set of stakeholders are the institutions from which she is diverting cases, the courts themselves.
We'd say, what are your frustrations? And law enforcement, often their frustration is, we keep arresting and rearresting the same people, but nothing happens at court, and they end up back in the community immediately. People in the courts have frustrations. Everybody is frustrated about the way our criminal justice system and our court system is not working.
Everyone seems to agree that the current system doesn't work.
When we say that, you know, well, here's a different way to try, you know, why not try this? And it makes a lot of sense. And when people would say, yeah, it does, let's try it, I thought, wow, that we're home free. Like, this was easy.
It should be easy.
But it wasn't, because the hard part is there's kind of this gulf between people in bureaucracies and institutions saying, yeah, this is a good idea. And there's a gulf that you have to cross between actually getting that idea implemented.
So there's a gulf. And this brings us back to this episode's theme, who comes to the negotiating table?
In the stories that Lauren has shared, some institutions, like the juvenile justice system, don't seem to want a seat at the table. They would just as easily carry on without her.
You know, it's kind of frustrating to say that after, you know, 18 years of doing diversion work with our juvenile justice system, we still have to go down there every single week and show our face and find out where the cases are and what's going on. Mm-hmm. If we didn't, it would just be like they would close around themselves and just continue to do things the way they normally do. Mm-hmm. It's a behemoth of a system with a whole lot of momentum. And I think until people start taking this kind of stuff seriously and start funding it at the level that they fund the courts, which is monstrous, that it's, you know, it's not just about implementing a program. It's about changing the culture. Yeah. And what's frustrating is that there are so many restorative justice programs or similar programs that have shown better social outcomes and cost savings, but they're still regarded as this nice little alternative thing to do.
The criminal justice system is so large and self-perpetuating that there seems to be little incentive for it to divert its actors or funds towards programs like Lauren's.
Unlike in Richard's case, the vision from government leaders does not necessarily favor inclusivity. It favors the status quo. And without the participation of these key institutional stakeholders,
like the courts,
it's impossible for others to benefit from the process. So Lauren is managing two different negotiations at the same time. The first, she's trying to get participants to conference about their conflicts. And the second, she's trying to convince the state to support her work. And the problem is that this latter negotiation can determine the first.
In other words, if the courts don't consistently refer cases to Lauren, the parties in those cases just won't have a chance to try conferencing.
In the late 90s, a lot of the high-rise public housing developments were imploded. Mm-hmm. And those residents were spread out among different neighborhoods in Baltimore. And as has been common when this happens, the neighborhoods where residents from subsidized housing are moving to, the neighbors there are often very angry about it. And they don't want, quote unquote, those people moving in. And so we tried to get our housing department, I tried to get our housing department to let us conduct dialogue circles with existing residents in the neighborhood with some of the families who were going to be moving in there, mm-hmm. so that they could, you know, have a chance to sit down, see who each other are, talk to each other, express any concerns, and say, look, we're going to live together. How can we do this the best way we can? But they wouldn't invest in it.
If you're negotiating to get rid of Iran's nuclear program, there's really no guarantee of success. You're in uncharted territory.
But in conferencing, there's more than just a shot at a good outcome. There's evidence of success and compliance, a dispute resolution process that works, and yet a hesitation from certain institutions to come to the table.
This stuff can be used in so many ways to address these issues, but we're not there yet, and we just have to push at every single moment to say, hey, how about this? And I can't tell you if I had $1,000 for every time some big policy initiative was happening where I think it really could have helped for people to sit and talk to each other. If I had $1,000 for every time I was rejected on that idea, we would have enough funding to last us for the rest of our lives.
Hopefully, we'll reach a tipping point. But until then, Lauren has to keep going.
Honestly, a huge part of what really keeps me going is to still do the work and to see what happens in those circles, because that's the heart of it for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where I really get my energy, and that's where I get my hopefulness, is, you know, when either I'm facilitating a circle or I hear a conference or I hear about one of my coworkers, you know, every week we talk about cases. And when I hear about what is still happening, it's like, this is the reason why we do this, and we just got to keep going.
Dr. Lauren Abramson is the executive director of the Community Conferencing Center in Baltimore, an assistant professor of child psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
The stories shared today raise a lot of compelling questions. In each situation, large groups of people had to decide on something, from a student's accommodations to the future of Iran's nuclear program to the appropriate forum for handling neighborhood disputes. And actually, there were a lot of similarities in their processes. They valued inclusivity, and they tried to take into account as many ideas as possible.
But they all had really different experiences. Nathan struggled to get people to the table in the first place. Parents were often missing from important conversations about their children, and he struggled with his own buy-in as a teacher. For Richard, too many people wanted a seat at the table. There are hundreds of stakeholders interested in Iran's nuclear capacity, but only 6 countries negotiated on behalf of the P5 plus 1. And Lauren was somewhere in between. Community members were enthusiastic about the process once they had done it, but the court system, arguably Lauren's most influential stakeholder, was often missing from negotiations.
So what's the difference here? Why do they have such contrasting experiences?
Is it something about their roles?
Their contexts?
Or who their counterparts were?
Or is it something else? Think about your own life. What metaphorical or literal tables are you a part of?
What tables do you avoid? What are the negotiations you'd like to have, but can't seem to get the key stakeholders to the table?
In the listening room, you'll hear stories of disputes, deals, and dilemmas, past and present.
You'll hear reflections from a diverse array of people about the disputes and conflicts that they have to manage. In true negotiation and mediation style, we'd love to hear your feedback. We invite you to join the conversation by leaving a comment in the comment field on our website.
We'd also love for you to send us a voice memo at hnmcplisteningroom@gmail.com. After each episode, we'll have a question we'd like to hear more about. For this week's voice memos, answer this. What are the negotiations you want to have, but you feel like the key people aren't at the table?
We're excited to hear what you have to say. You can also learn more about HNMCP by following us on Facebook at Harvard Law Negotiation Mediation and on Twitter at HNMCP.
Thank you, of course, to our interviewees, Nathan Abelman, Richard Nephew, and Dr. Lauren Abramson for their time.
This podcast would not be possible without the support and mentorship of the Harvard Negotiation and Mediation Clinical Program. We developed content for this episode with the help of our amazing team of first-year HLS students and HLS negotiators, Nathan Abelman, Pavni Garj, Yuni Han, Dawei Liu, and Ray Samunshi. They offered insights, suggestions, and feedback throughout the project.
And we want to especially thank our amazing producer, Mitch Hanley, for making this podcast possible.